for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Suicide car bomb attacks in Kabul today targeted foreigners, killing at least 18 people. Taliban militants claimed responsibility. The Netherlands announced general elections in June. The government collapsed last weekend over disagreements on Dutch troop involvement in Afghanistan. The Federal Reserve is investigating whether Wall Street firms helped obscure the severity of Greece's debt crisis. And India and Pakistan made little progress in their first high-level talks in 18 months. Joining me for a look at the week's top international news stories on the Friday News Roundup, Tom Shanker of the New York Times, Farris Stockman of the Boston Globe, and David Wood of PoliticsDaily.com. We do invite your calls, questions. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. And you can join us on Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Tom Shanker, do we know very much about this suicide bombing in Kabul?
Well, first, reports are often wrong, Diane, as we've discussed in the past. But what the initial reports from the field are, a very large vehicle-borne suicide bomber hit one of the guest house hotels, killing 18 people. Initial reports were that it was nationals from India and Italy. But the more we're hearing is it's mostly Indians. And it's a very complicated political issue because Afghanistan is part of the great game going on between Pakistan and India today. So if the Taliban are specifically targeting Indians in Afghanistan, it is certainly to ratchet up the tensions between Pakistan and India, which is important to the Taliban in this sort of three-dimensional chess, because if Pakistan and Indian tensions remain high, then Pakistan can do less against the Taliban.
David.
It also, Diane, speaks to the enormously poisonous atmosphere in Afghanistan and the enormous difficulty of even a strong government to prevent this kind of thing from happening. But again, it points up the Taliban's boast that it can strike anywhere at any time and cause enormous casualties. And the Karzai government, and by extension the United States, is powerless against it.
Farah.
Well, I just want to note that it comes on the heels of some very good news stories about Afghanistan this week. The Marja offensive came out about with some very positive headlines in U.S. papers saying, yeah, there's a glimpse of hope. Maybe we really can win this thing. And so it's just a reminder that these guys can strike anywhere. That's what they're trying to say.
One wonders whether the attack in Kabul comes as a direct relationship to what's going on in Marja.
I think that's certainly true. And if we really want to step back and broaden our horizon here, the Taliban not only attacked in Kabul, but by implication, they attacked in the Netherlands as well. Not directly, not with a car bomb, but it's the violence on the ground that is so responsible for the collapse of the government of the Netherlands over what question? Whether their 2,000 troops in Afghanistan should stay beyond the end of the year. So while the CIA and the Pakistan government are claiming they've rounded up to half of the Taliban leadership, well, the Taliban leadership just brought down the government of a powerful NATO ally.
What do we know about the airstrike in Marja that apparently killed 28 civilians? What do we know about responsibility for that? I realize there's still an investigation underway. What do we know so far, David?
Well, Diane, there were a series of mishaps in Marja, which is a town in southern Afghanistan where there was a Taliban stronghold, and the U.S. has been promising for months to go in and invade and clean the place out, and indeed they did just that this in the past 10 days. There were any number of civilians killed. I think the Afghan Human Rights Commission said there were 28, but there were a lot of civilians killed. part of the problem is the difficulty of defining what is a civilian. And as we know, in this kind of conflict, there are people who sort of drift in and out of the ranks of the fighters. And so it's kind of hard to tell. I think the bigger problem is that the U.S. is pursuing a, in essence, a conventional industrial age military strategy in Marja, not unlike what you saw during the American Civil War 150 years ago, which is to say you send in columns of infantry backed by, of course, not in the Civil War, but in this case, backed by air power and artillery. It's exactly like a set-piece Civil War strategy. And with all that iron flying through the air from ground weapons and from helicopters and jet fighters, people are bound to get hurt. You can't avoid it. And as much as the U.S. forces have tried to minimize civilian casualties, and I have been with air crews and ground combat units in which they're doing an extraordinarily painful, difficult job of trying to prevent this from happening, it's just inevitable.
I would never want to argue with my esteemed colleague, Dave, one of the smartest guys I know, but I'm going to argue with you anyway today. It's definitely an industrial-era conflict on the ground, but they have wedded with that some real information age ideas that you didn't see during the Civil War. I mean, they announced in advance the attack was coming. Why? So the civilians would leave and the Taliban, to a certain extent, could flee. They also set up a government in waiting, hoping to rush in as soon as possible, set up services. This battle is less about body counts, seizing a crossroads, taking the high ground, than about shaping the thinking of the Afghan people. And that's a whole new way of thinking about the impact of war.
Now, you also had at least 24,000 people fleeing Farrokhstan.
Sure. And you've seen a lot of people come back. I mean, they raised the Afghan flag this week over Marja, and it was carefully choreographed so that you could show that this is the Afghan government coming in. The Marine commander didn't speak. And so this is a real test of McChrystal's strategy, whether or not, I mean, we've cleared Marja before. Can we hold it? And they're coming in with money to pay day laborers, to put money in people's pockets. And I think that that's where you will see whether this strategy wins or loses. I think the Taliban enjoyed deep popularity there, partly because the Taliban allowed people to grow poppies, which was their livelihood. Now I think people wonder, well, how will we make our living? And so these are the questions that, that need to be answered.
And, of course, General David Petraeus on Sunday's Meet the Press said that the surge in Marja is the start of a long campaign to defeat the Taliban. Is this realistic, David?
Well, we'll see. I mean, one of the interesting things about Marja is that it's the battle for Marja has hardly begun, as my esteemed colleague Tom has said, joining the colloquy here. You know, the mechanical, the kinetic part of the fight is only just begun, and it's, you know, the question is whether you can transplant a government into this fairly alien place, transplant it in from Kabul with a bunch of Iraqi politicians who are not from there. It's the McChrystal's government in a box concept where, you know, you just load the place up with government services. The entire U.S. strategy in Afghanistan has been we provide security. We help the Afghan government establish itself, and that's how we will keep stability here and keep the Taliban at bay. Well, we've only just begun in Marja and hardly anywhere else in the country.
I mean, Diane, you ask really the fundamental question, and, you know, General McChrystal has described the Taliban as a cancer, and that's a useful metaphor because despite all the billions spent on medical research, it's unlikely we'll ever find an absolute cure for cancer in the human body. There is no way to defeat or completely eradicate the Taliban. It's a process that Dave was just describing of minimizing and marginalizing a force that will always be there.
And Farah Stockman, meantime, the casualty rate for U.S. soldiers has neared a new level of almost 1,000. How is that affecting U.S. attitudes about the war?
Well, I think that the important thing has been keeping morale up. When U.S. soldiers are being asked not to call in fire air power in the same way that they used to before, I mean, people are really they're taking a lot of risks to protect Afghan civilians, and to the point where, you know, they're being denied Hellfire missiles and these other things that would have protected them so that they can protect the Afghan population. But I think, you know, the question is whether the military can bend the trajectory in their favor and whether they feel that they've got momentum, whether they feel they're doing something that's getting the support of the Afghan people and the American people, frankly. And so if they feel like, hey, we're doing something important and people are supporting us, then I think you'll still see you'll see some morale rise.
Now, what about Pakistan's role in arresting what they claim are nearly half the Taliban senior leadership in recent days? Has Pakistan actually, really changed their approach to the Taliban?
Well, this is certainly a very aggressive program, but as we've reported, some of these roll-ups have been accidental. They've gone to a safe house and, you know, one of the senior guys just happened to be there. So I wouldn't want to undermine the importance of what Pakistan is doing, but we also can't, you know, sort of believe that just because leaders have been, you know, arrested or whacked that the Taliban is crippled. I mean, the military's been doing a good job of getting high-value targets for a number of years. This is an organism that seems able to regenerate, although every time you trim it back, that's certainly a positive.
David.
And I think one of the things, interesting things that I've noticed is, pardon me, when one of the Taliban is killed in a drone attack or removed by a detention, the guy that takes his place is worse. He's more radical. He's more extreme. He's more aggressive. And that's a problem for us.
David Wood of PoliticsDaily.com, Tom Shanker of The New York Times, Farrah Stockman of The Boston Globe. Short break, and when we come back, we'll talk about Iran, what's happening there. Take your calls. Welcome back. And just before the break, we were talking about U.S. casualties in the war in Afghanistan. David, you wanted to add to that.
I just wanted to mention that the history of U.S. involvement in wars and public support for those wars seems to be linked to the idea that if people think we're winning, if people think that there's progress being made, then they will put up with a certain level of casualties. If they think it's a lost cause, you know, it doesn't almost matter what the casualties are. They're going to bail out, which appears to be the case here, even though if you looked at it just from a statistical point of view, you know, we're just now reaching 1,000 battle deaths in Afghanistan, which is horrible and tragic. There were over 4,000 Americans killed in Iraq during that war, which is still going on, and 82,000 wounded, American wounded from the two wars so far. And that's a cost, that's a phenomenon. We don't see these people. Their names are not announced. They're largely invisible, but there are many of them bearing burdens for the rest of their lives. I looked just this morning at the average age of the soldiers and Marines who were killed this month in Afghanistan, 23 and a half years old.
Oh, what a tragedy, Truly. Farrah Stockman, Pakistan, India resumed peace talks yesterday. Why are these talks so important?
Well, it's the first talks that they've had since the Mumbai attacks in 2008. And although they didn't really talk about anything substantial, they billed it as a first step to rebuild trust. And I think in the bigger picture, the U.S. government has been trying to convince Pakistan that its real enemy, its real existential threat is not India, but these insurgents, these Taliban, these many, many militant groups inside Pakistan's borders, which Pakistan used to use against India. And which now have come back to bite them. And so I think that's another reason why these arrests by Pakistan are so interesting, because everybody's looking there, all holding their breath to see, has Pakistan's military, has its ISI actually, is it changing its thinking? Is it starting to see these guys as a threat and as a force to move against?
Has there been an announcement for a next meeting, David?
No, they did not. They talked vaguely about how they ought to meet again and, you know, see you later kind of thing. But interestingly, there was no date set. One of the dynamics here, which is really scary, I think, is that the terrorist groups inside Pakistan, which were involved in the Mumbai attacks, are still extant there. They're still operating. They have not really, Pakistanis, especially in the view of Indians, have not really cracked down on these groups. And it's thought that if there's another attack from Pakistan on India, terrorist attack like the Mumbai attacks, or even worse, a series of attacks, that India will be really forced to retaliate this time. Prime Minister Singh has been trying to tamp that down and explain that we're in the process of meeting with them and working through this. But public opinion, I think this time, and many observers think that this time, if there's another Mumbai, India will retaliate.
And, of course, both those nations do possess nuclear weapons.
They both have nuclear weapons. They've both fomented, insurgency and unrest in the other country. And the real issue here, wonderful it is that they sat down and had a partial kumbaya moment, they didn't get anywhere toward resolving the fundamental issue, which is Kashmir. And so until you resolve that, all of the holding hands and urging by Washington to be better friends will be meaningless.
All right, let's move on. What do you make of Iran strengthening its ties to Syria, Tom Shanker?
Well, it's very interesting. The United States is, working at so many levels in the Middle East, and there have been a time, and we've sort of forgotten that in the first Gulf War against Iraq, Syria and Saudi troops were, on the American left and right flank. But recent attempts to sort of, reach out to the Syrian government of Assad, were showing a little promise. They announced recently that an American ambassador would be returning for the first time in 5 years. So whether there's a different dialogue publicly than privately, all we know is that this week, the very radical Iranian president was in Damascus, and so Ahmadinejad and Assad held a press conference in which they said basically to the U.S., hands off, we are the friends, not you. I think it was very, very disappointing here in Washington, even if it wasn't unexpected.
And, of course, President Obama recently nominated Robert Ford to be the new ambassador to Damascus. And now you see this kind of strengthening of ties. What does that mean?
Well, I mean, Iran and Syria have had strong ties for years, and they've signed non-aggression pacts and all kinds of things. I think this week they announced that they would waive visa requirements. And so I'm not sure to what extent this is Assad's way of reassuring Iran that, hey, I'm not going completely on to the American side. But the Syrians are clearly interested in having closer ties with Washington. They held their first National Day last year, which was attended by senior State Department officials. I mean, there's been a thaw, and I think the Americans might be getting something for that. We might not just be hearing about it publicly.
And David Wood, Iran also announced the arrest of a Sunni rebel, it says, has links to the U.S.
This is a wonderful story. It reminds me of North Korea. Every time North Korea gets in a squeeze, it invents some little crisis that it can really trumpet. And in this case, there's a really minor character, almost a brigand, name is Abdul Malik Riga, and he operates in that part of Iran which is sandwiched between Afghanistan and Pakistan, so it's sort of a wild area. And he runs some drugs and he mounts some terrorist attacks, but really a pretty minor character. Well, he was picked up by the Iranian authorities who quickly alleged that he had been working with the Americans and was sort of going to be a U.S.-supported rebel thorn in the side of the Iranian authorities. He has now allegedly confessed to his crime, saying he met with the CIA, that they promised him weapons and a base inside Afghanistan from which to mount attacks on Iran. And it's great theater.
Farah.
Well, I do think the Iranians have been after this guy for a long time. Jandallah has launched an attack on a bus that killed Revolutionary Guard members. I mean, they've been launching terrorist attacks inside Iran for years, and I think they killed his brother a few years ago, and now they've got him. It is a big win for them. They have been looking for this guy. He's a Baluch separatist, and there are Baluch separatists both in Pakistan and in Iran, and they cause a lot of trouble, and so this is a big coup for them. The circumstances of his arrest are kind of murky, and Mahmoud Ahmadinejad says, we're going to make a movie about it. You know, he's so excited. So it's interesting. And it is also interesting, though, that the State Department has declined for years to put Jandallah on the terrorism list.
Interesting.
And I have asked them many times why that is. And so that's the one thing that leaves a doubt in my mind as to whether the U.S. has actually had ties with Jandallah.
Tom Shankar.
But timing is important, not just in comedy and courtship, but in politics as well. And this arrest came literally 1 week after General Ray Odierno, the senior American commander in Iraq, was in Washington, spoke very forcefully and for the first time about Iranian influence in the upcoming elections in Iraq and the fact that two leading Shiite politicians had been in Iran recently meeting with Quds forces commanders who were on the terror watch list. So this is a lot of sort of, you know, tic-tac-toe and tit-for-tat going on here.
Now, what about these elections scheduled for March 7? We're told that the anti-American bloc is gaining power, Tom.
Well, it's a very complicated situation. The Shia majority have been trying to block some of the Sunni candidates on the grounds that some of their leaders were former members of the Saddam Hussein political party, the Ba'ath Party. Many of the parties were going to stay out of the election. They just announced this morning they got wisdom and they will participate after all. Mm-hmm. Although, you know, if it's a fair majority rule vote, they're going to lose. But the Shiite government did something else very interesting. It reinstated several thousand, maybe 10 to 20,000 former Saddam-era military officers, not at the highest levels, but at the mid-levels. So there's lots of politicking mm-hmm. going on, which overall is healthy, and it's probably going to be 30, 60, or 90 days after the vote whether we see whether it will be a stable movement forward or whether things fall apart.
And how strong is Nouri al-Maliki right now, the prime minister?
Well, he's in the driver's seat, so he has all the advantages of incumbency. But the problem is, again, we see that in these, very tense kind of confrontations, it's the more radical people who always get the upper hand. In this case, it's Mokhtar el-Sadr, who is, I think the name Firebrand is permanently attached to his name. He's an extremist Islamic cleric and led a militia which fought bitterly against U.S. forces for years and was sort of based in Sadr City and so on. It's likely that he will have a major hand in the next government. And so the interesting thing is, so what? He can have a lot of anti-American rhetoric and so forth, which would be politically helpful, but what will it actually mean? U.S. Ambassador to Iraq, Chris Hill, said the other day that he'd gotten assurances from major Iraqi political figures that whatever agreements Iraq had reached under the current government would still be held by whoever takes power next. He also said that they'd agreed during his campaign to be nice to each other, not to call each other names, and abide by the outcome of the election. So who knows?
Fair. But
Well, it's just fascinating to watch Iraqi politics unfold. And if you go back to the days when we were orchestrating everything and the people we put in power, and now it's just going to be a surprise to see what happens.
Tom Schenker, you talked earlier about the connection between what's happening in Afghanistan and the Dutch government. The Dutch cabinet collapsed over the issue, as you said, troops in Afghanistan. What's the response been to that?
Right. Thus far, the American government and most NATO allies have sort of held fire in their commentary, because just as the government fell apart, it could fall back together again. That's what happens in coalition governments. And so they're waiting to see. The bad news this week, though, was that NATO held this thing called the Force Generation Conference. And it's where they literally sit down with pads and pencils and troop numbers, and they once again came up very short in the numbers of trainers required. So until the politics get settled in these NATO capitals, there won't be the troops necessary for the mission.
And, of course, the New York Times editorial said, we fear the Dutch decision could provide cover for wavering politicians elsewhere. Germany, for example, or Canada, which is now scheduled to pull out troops at the end of 2011, could this start sort of a chain reaction?
We were in Istanbul with Secretary Gates for NATO ministerial just 10 days ago, and a senior NATO diplomat said to me, none of us want to be the last person to go out. None of us want to be the first.
Tom Schenker of the New York Times. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. You want to add to that, David?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that there was actually, that provoked a very sharp reaction in Washington. Secretary Gates made a speech, I think on Monday, where he really, I mean, you know, Secretary Gates is a nice guy. He doesn't often do this, but boy, he just exploded.
He sure did.
In a speech to NATO officials meeting here in Washington, saying basically that they hadn't met their commitments in Afghanistan and it was impeding the war effort there, that they needed to, fulfill their obligations to provide more cargo planes, helicopters, intelligence gathering platforms, and a whole list of things. And he said that NATO suffers from systemic, long-term, serious problems.
But at the same time, many of these countries are also suffering financially, as is Greece, and unwilling to put more money into military resources. The Federal Reserve is looking at Wall Street's possible connection with Greece's financial difficulty. Meanwhile, you've got protests, you've got strikes going on in Greece this week. Why, Farah?
Well, Greece is actually the most indebted nation in the EU. It's going to be interesting to see how the EU financial institutions deal with this. They could actually come in and force Greece to take some measures. And American banks are now under fire. It looks like they helped Greece hide its debt and that they maybe sold products to Greece, which allowed Greece to continue to borrow money and continue to spend. And so basically, the government right now in Greece is introducing some austerity measures. They're trying to cut pay of civil servants by 5.5%. Sounds like the Boston Globe. They're also increasing the retirement years from 35 years to 37 to increase your pension. They're talking about raising taxes. And now Greece is a country where 20% of its citizens live below the EU poverty line. And so people are striking. You're seeing a lot of civil strife.
So you've got these credit default swaps that were at work in this country sold to Greece, apparently, by Goldman Sachs and other big banks.
Yeah, the SEC apparently is going to be looking into that. The problem is that you had these big, powerful American banks basically betting that Greece would go down the drain and thereby hastening that very thing from happening.
And, of course, the effects on the European market generally have been traumatic.
Well, of course, many of the nations that joined the common currency did so when the economies were strong, but now they're all being sucked down. So even those whose currencies are a little stronger, whose economy is stronger, will have to pay the price here because all of Europe is linked by the single currency that Greece has thrown overboard with a heavy anchor.
So how are they going to get out of this mess?
I hope not through mortgages.
I don't know, Diane, and it's interesting that I don't think anybody knows how they're going to get out of this. This is an absolutely unprecedented situation, and of course, the Europeans are terrified, at not just for their own monetary interest, but because they had this great experiment where we're going to link the whole of Europe together in a single monetary union, and it will help everybody. Well, it's turning out maybe that's not the case.
And the question becomes whether Germany is going to step in and save not only the day, but the union.
Right.
How possible is that?
Well, I mean, it's certainly the strong economy, but they've been tapped ever since the wall came down in 89 to pay off everyone else's debt. I mean, the people who look really smart right now is the Exchequer of the United Kingdom.
Tom Shanker of the New York Times, David Wood of PoliticsDaily.com, Farris Stockman of the Boston Globe. When we come back, we're going to open the phones, read your email. Join us, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. By the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. This is NPR.
I've wept for those who suffer long.
On the next Fresh Air, on what would have been Johnny Cash's 78th birthday, we dedicate the show to him. We'll hear some music from the sixth and final album in his American recording series, produced by Rick Rubin. And we'll listen back to interviews with Cash and Rubin. Join us.
It's in the soul to feel such things.
Welcome back to the international portion of the Friday News Roundup, this week with David Wood of PoliticsDaily.com, Farris Stockman at the Boston Globe, Tom Shanker of the New York Times. We'll go right to the phones to Kingsport, Tennessee. Good morning, Patty. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you. My question is, if we're still seeing all of these suicide bomb attacks, we're still seeing a steady incline of soldiers being killed, we're still seeing terrorist attacks made by the Taliban, are we making progress with this fight against the Taliban?
It's a good question. Farris Stockman.
Well, I think if you talk to some senior military commanders, they will say, well, we're not trying to get to zero violence. What we're trying to do is put the Taliban on the defensive in order to force them to make a deal, or at least some of them to make a deal. I think, you know, that's the realistic point of view. The question is whether such a deal would stick. We've got to see what Karzai has in mind when he talks about talking with the Taliban.
Tom.
Violence will never go to zero, just as Farah said. It's a war for perceptions, not for territory or for bodies. And can some success in Marja and elsewhere convince the sort of undecided and the fearful and the fence-sitters to join the Karzai government? That's what the fight's all about.
One caller asks, Bear Stearns relationship to the Greek government's economic problems and how they handled their books. David Wood.
I think one of the things we've learned over the last few months is how opaque all of this stuff is, whether Bear Stearns had a hand in Greece's downfall. Isn't clear at this point, and that's why the SEC is going to, and their famously sharp gumshoes are going to be looking into this. But we don't know at this
point. All right. To Austin, Texas. Andrew, thanks for joining us. Go right ahead. Andrew, are you there?
Hi, Diane. I'm here. My comment is in regards to how India and Pakistan is treated almost the same way in the media. India is a more secular country, Pakistan is Islamic, and India is pushing a game in Afghanistan, an anti-Taliban force pushing for a more secular, maybe a moderate version of Islam in Afghanistan. So it almost seems like they should not be treated in the same plane, and you know, India is fighting for, you know, the cause that America is fighting for, as opposed to, you don't know where the ISI ends and where the Taliban begins. They are all together, as opposed to the Indian forces, which have been fighting, you know, Taliban-related forces in Kashmir as well.
Farah Stockman.
Well, we definitely share more common values with India, and India's economy is more intertwined with ours. But I think Pakistan is key to terrorism, and they have a place at the table. They completely joined. Well, I guess that's debatable. But they in after 9/11, we said, are you with us or against us? And they said, we're with you. And so, you know, they've had a lot of a lot of attacks inside Pakistan itself. They've really suffered. The population has suffered. And so I think to tell the Pakistanis, oh, we're not going to treat you equally with India, will not make the Pakistanis feel like we're a trustworthy ally.
All right. To Petrog, New York. Hiya, Holly. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you? I'd like to address the following. It's my understanding that perhaps the clogs of Iran are going up into the mountains of Pakistan and are using themselves as mullahs for the farmers in Afghanistan. The farmers in Afghanistan do not trust the Afghani government. So therefore, these clogs of Iran are mediating differences between the farmers, making the farmers, neither one of them right or wrong, thereby recruiting them as Talibanis. Is this not true?
David Putt.
Well, one of the things that we've learned about this part of the world is that the loyalty and support of local farmers is critical, and Afghanistan is mostly agricultural, and most of these people are hostile to the idea of foreign government, including their own, and that there's definitely a place for this kind of support coming from elsewhere. So, you know, this kind of thing is happening all over
Afghanistan. Are you saying that they're hostile to any form of government, including their own?
My experience, and very limited talking to Afghanis about this kind of thing, is that they're suspicious of any outsiders.
Outsiders.
In many cases, if you are in Helmand Province or you're in eastern Afghanistan, Kabul is foreign.
And even more than province to the central government, valley to valley, you have differences. And some of the problems the American and coalition forces have found is they'll set up a command outpost in one valley, hoping for the support of a broader area, but they get caught in sort of this, you know, intramural fight, this valley to the next, over logging and export and even over what kind of cheese they eat.
All right. To Grand Rapids, Michigan. Good morning, Jose. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. I wonder if the panel could comment on what is our foreign the major theme of our foreign policy. Usually, from Truman on, most presidents had a theme, whether it was human rights for Carter or détente. And this president came to the White House speaking about sitting down and talking without preconditions. Is that still the policy, and how would that apply now that a civil rights leader have died of a hunger strike in Cuba? And then I'll listen up.
In Cuba, hunger strike or Farah?
I do think Obama has come into office talking about engaging with enemies, and he has loosened some restrictions on Cuba, and he's reached out to the people of Iran, but he still deals with the same reality, and he still has the same goals as previous presidents. So if Iran doesn't take you up on it, what do you do next? And so I think that the theme will play itself out. We'll have to see if he has a plan B when engagement doesn't work.
I wonder whether our previous caller, Jose, was also wondering about the ties between Iran and Venezuela, which are becoming apparent. Tom?
Well, Venezuela's been a very interesting challenge. Chavez has also reached out to Russia, and has, you know, there's been military visits and all of that. I think thus far the Obama administration, especially Secretary Gates, the person I follow more, you know, keep an eye on it, but they're not especially worried about what's going on in Venezuela. He's a local issue, perhaps even, you know, with his neighbors, but not a threat to the United States.
All right, to Ocala, Florida. Good morning, Vino.
Yeah, good morning, Diane. Good to be on your show.
Thank you.
I wanted to comment on India versus Pakistan and how U.S. Foreign policy relates to these two countries. I think that American policy is, or foreign policy is, flawed in this context. That Pakistan actually created the Taliban. ISI was behind creating Taliban. And secondly, Pakistan tacitly or directly supports terrorist activities, and I don't think they're worthy of being regarded as our allies. It's a terrorist nation, and America needs to modify its foreign policy vis-a-vis Pakistan and India.
David,
I think the caller makes a good point, but again, the problem is whether we consider them allies or friends or neutrals or enemies, we've got to help manage them. This is a really, really dangerous part of the world, as you've alluded to, Diane, with both countries with nuclear weapons, a lot of terrorism, a lot of tension, a lot of things that could go wrong in a heartbeat, and the U.S. has to be engaged. And one of the interesting things about this whole period here is that, a previous caller asked about what is the U.S. foreign policy. It's very unclear, and the most specific document we have recently is the Pentagon's Quadrennial Defense Review, which sort of laid out what the national security strategy is. And basically it said, we have to be ready for everything, which was pretty astonishing. So it's an interesting period to watch.
Sarah.
I just want to say that sometimes you need to use the poison to make the cure. And without Pakistan, we can't stop terrorism. If we're able to convince Pakistan that it's not in their long-term interest to support these groups, then we have a real chance in Afghanistan. As long as Pakistan is a safe haven for these groups, then we're really dead in the water.
One caller asks, is it possible that Greece's involvement with NATO contributed to its financial problems?
I haven't heard that case made yet. And in fact, all of the European countries are so far below the NATO-mandated percentage of contributions to their national military that I just don't think that, you know, whatever the 1 or 2% of GNP that Greece spends on its military is the fundamental problem here.
And the fundamental problem being?
Bad investments, bad government, carrying too much debt.
Profligacy?
That's a wonderful word, Diane.
All right. To Rochester, New York. Good morning, David. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for having me on your show. I always enjoy it.
I'm glad.
My comment or question is, don't you feel that if either positively or negatively that our country is viewed by other countries because our foreign policy changes depending on the administration, and with this, for example, with regard to Afghanistan, years ago when Afghanistan was fighting the Soviets, a la Charlie Wilson, that we gave arms and other goods that they needed to fight the war against the Soviets. Now we're in Afghanistan, maybe fighting some of the same people that we armed back then.
What do you think, David?
I was just thinking about a Afghan police chief I spent some time with last fall, a wonderful guy who had been a policeman since 1980, so he'd lived through a lot of Afghan history. We talked for hours, and when I left, he held my hand and said, "Don't leave us." I said, "I'm sorry." He said, "Don't leave us." The Afghans are terrified that we're going to do again what we did once, which was just abandon them.
And of course, one of the other striking differences between the Bush administration and, at least thus far, any statement on the part of the Obama administration is that role of preemptive strikes.
That's true, although we'll have to wait and see. It was mentioned earlier, the Quadrennial Defense Review. We're probably some days or weeks away from the release of the Nuclear Posture Review, and it's unclear what the president will say then about preemption. But you're making a point. This is a very vital issue for all of us to keep an eye on.
Tom Shanker of the New York Times. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And now to Josette, who's in Miami, Florida. Hi there. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. My question really has to do with why we are in Afghanistan. Obviously, it's because of 9/11. But when we went in, we were fighting al-Qaeda. The Taliban was never accused of having a hand in the attack. So how did this evolve into our fighting the Taliban rather than al-Qaeda? We could pull out, resolve the problem of deficits in our budget, and now we are being told that if the conflict in Iraq between the Sunnis and Shiite keep going on, we might stay there longer.
Certainly, confusion, conflation of the enemy. Farah.
Well, as I said before, the Bush administration said after 9/11, you're either with us or against us. And the Taliban refused to hand over Osama bin Laden, and so we took them out. And, I wonder what would have happened if Mullah Omar had handed over Osama bin Laden or had cooperated in some way. History would have been very different. At the time, the Bush administration had this idea that Afghanistan would be a failed state, and failed states were also places where terrorists could fester. Of course, we've seen failed states multiply. We're looking at Yemen. We're looking at Somalia now. So I think the caller makes a very good point. I will also say, though, that Afghanistan and Pakistan, that region of the world, is a place where something like 80% of the terrorist attacks in Britain were planned there. I don't know the percentage for the United States, but it would be pretty high.
Now, I want to ask you all about the Olympics, because there's been talk of a Cold War in regard to that. They wrap up this weekend. What's that all about, Tom?
Well, it's been a wonderful narrative, whether you like sports or whether you like politics or personality and drama. And all I can think, Diane, is to quote one of my favorite foreign policy analysts, Elmer Fudd, who would say, "Those wascally Russians." I mean, it's just been incredible. The Russian top skater came in second. You know, that country is certainly familiar with bad judging and wrong judging. And the American who took the gold was, acclaimed as just having skated better that night. What did the Russian skater do? When he comes out for a silver, he stands atop in the gold place and waves to the audience. Now, I don't know what his mom and dad taught him, but my mom and dad taught me that's bad manners.
It's interesting. There have been a number of those kinds of things. My favorite is Apollo Ono, who was this American speed skater, hated by the South Koreans, who put his face on toilet paper. But the striking thing is that these are individual dramas,
sure.
not the kind of collective, you know, America versus the Soviet Union that we saw a generation
and
ago.
And, you know, we've gotten a tweet asking how much did having the Olympics in Greece contribute to that country's financial problems, Tom?
That's a terrific question. I haven't done any reporting. I would doubt that Greece has spent sort of the billions required to, you know, to have, the, you know, the
massive buildings and the like.
Exactly. But that's a very good question. That'd be a great assignment for a good economics reporter.
How do you think these games are going to be remembered, Farah?
I would say that people are going to remember the American hockey victory. I was listening last night to a member of the 1958 team who was talking about the great camaraderie that they had with the Russian players back then. I don't know if this year's games are going to be remembered like that.
Farah Stockman, the Boston Globe, Tom Schenker at the New York Times, David Wood, PoliticsDaily.com. I'm sure we'll all be watching the finales this weekend. Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.